Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I was once lost, but now I'm found. Listen to John Schaefer on Soundcheck.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and we've got a kind of a theme, an unexpected theme, at least for a radio show, namely, watching music. For example, if you've seen any of Darren Aronofsky's films, like Stoker, the one that's out now, or The Wrestler, or The Fountain, then you've sort of watched Clint Mansell's music as it sets the mood and maybe cues you into the psyche of the various characters. Mansell actually presented some of his film music here in New York last week, and our engineering crew was there. That's originally from Clint Mansell's score to the film Requiem for a Dream, but this recording was made at the Church of St. Paul the Apostle last week by our online sister station Q2 and the Wordless Music Series. You can hear the whole thing by clicking on the link at our website, soundcheck.org, and you can hear Clint Mansell joining us later. There's also a literal visual component to our live performance from the Brooklyn band called Lucius. They play their blend of 60s soul and indie rock in matching costumes. It's all very visual. So you can watch our video of their in-studio performance on our website, soundcheck.org. But when it comes to watching music in action, suddenly museums are the place to be. Yesterday on the show, we heard about three exhibits in New York museums that use music as a jumping-off point, but there's another exhibition happening here in New York, and it's even more directly about the experience of watching music. It's called Spectacle, the Music Video. Spectacle is at the Museum of the Moving Image in Astoria, Queens, and it charts the evolution of the music video from MTV to YouTube. Maura Johnston wrote about the show for her new app-based publication, Maura Magazine. Maura, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thank you.
Do music videos, do they make a case that the music video belongs in a museum?
Oh, absolutely. There is so much footage. There's like 20 hours of footage, and there are so many just stunning videos. I found myself just entranced by what I was seeing, even when they were videos that I had seen multiple times, just watching them on endless loops that are, there are screens sort of scattered throughout the museum, and watching these clips again, for the first time, especially in the age of YouTube, where, sometimes you'll just see, a very small box and having these clips, blown up to flat-screen TV size is just astonishing. The cinematography in some of them is really great. There's Kanye West's video for Power, which he called a moving painting at the time. And, everyone was like, oh, it's a moving painting. It's Kanye being grandiose again. But then it's put in an actual frame and you see, how detailed and rich it really is.
So the actual experience of the thing that you've perhaps seen in a little thumbnail on your computer screen.
Yeah.
Becomes different.
Becomes totally different, yeah. And then there's one room where the videos are just blown up to the size of a wall and you see Like a Prayer just in, this gorgeous 5-foot representation. Smells Like Teen Spirit, where Kurt Cobain is life-size. It's really, really neat, yeah.
So we're asking our listeners, what's the first music video that made an impact on you? a lot of the possible answers to that question are probably represented in this thing.
Yeah, there are a lot of them. You know, I actually realized this morning that Michael Jackson isn't in there and Prince isn't either. I'm just going to guess it was some sort of licensing, you know, deal. But there's so much. I mean, the one video that I saw that, you know, made a huge impact on just the way I thought about everything was Herbie Hancock's clip for Rocket, which was this really amazing, you know, robotic tableau that was all of this, you know, a disembodied pair of legs walking around and all of these ways of the synthesizer sound sort of coming to life with these mannequins and robots and various triggers that matched up with the music.
And it's sort of hard, it's a chicken and egg thing. Was the song a huge hit because of the video? Was the video a huge hit because the song was groundbreaking?
Yeah.
We can't play the video on the radio, but you can at least hear some of what Maura's talking about. This is Herbie Hancock's Rocket. Hancock's Rocket from 1983, a groundbreaking song for the jazz pianist and also for the form of the music video. And Maura Johnston, the editor of Maura Magazine and instructor at NYU's Clive Davis School, is with me on Soundcheck reviewing the exhibit at the Museum of the Moving Image in Astoria. It's called Spectacle, the music video. Soundcheck listeners, what's the first music video that made an impact on you? You can tweet us at Soundcheck or leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612. So Rocket did it for you, Maura.
Definitely, yeah.
And it sort of raises the idea of the art form. The music video is art, you know, because we've seen a lot of great directors come out of the art form of the music video. In this case, it was Godley and Cream.
Oh, yeah, that's
Kevin
right.
Godley, Lal Cream, who were the founders of the band 10cc.
Yes, yes. And who, I remember, that was another video that actually made an impact on me, was their video for their own song, Cry, which was, you know, that it used a bunch of images of people crying, and it was this sort of weird antecedent to morphing, almost. Like, you know, where it was, they wiped the screen with the faces, and people's, like, mouths would morph into one another.
Right.
So,
Godley and Cream became early auteurs in the world of the music video. But then, since then, it's just been a parade of people going from music videos all over to Hollywood.
Oh, yeah. You have Michel Gondry, you have Spike Jonze, you know, and so much of their work is in the exhibit. I mean, it's really amazing to just think that these were things that were being beamed into homes, you know, on a regular basis. The clip for Wax's California, which is, you know, Spike Jonze's clip of just the guy running down on fire in super slow motion. And that was such a iconic video for me, even though, you know, I wasn't really into the band, but just the image was so striking. And it was, you know, on something that you could just flip across on TV in one afternoon. It was really, it was such a great age for that sort of auteurism and, you know, just to see the early work of these directors who then went on to make these great movies is just, it's really astonishing.
Well, you mentioned Michel Gondry. He did the great Lego video.
Yes, and there's actually one of the rooms in the exhibit is all themed after, you know, the blocks and stuff are, you know, big Lego blocks, and then there is an actual Lego from that video on display. There's some great artifacts, too, like the milk carton that walks around in Blur's video for Coffee and TV. There's a life-size replica of it. There's one of the arches from the White Stripes Seven Nation Army. You also see, you know, certain artists just keep recurring. I mean,
right.
Kanye West, White Stripes have so many great videos. Bjork. It's really kind of, you know, a great capsule of what music has been. What music has been great, too.
Well, I know the first time I took note of the name of Michel Gondry was when he did the Lego video for the band White Stripes for this song, Fell in Love with a Girl.
Fell in love with a girl. I fell in love once and I'm almost consider a cheat thing now. Red hair with a curl. Miller roll for the finger and the eyes for beeping. Can't keep a whip on the girl. Seen stars in my brain, need a hell of a meeting. Can't think of anything to do, yeah. My left brain knows that her love is fleeting. She's just looking for something new, yeah. Said it once before, but it bears repeating now.
Fell in Love with a Girl, 2001 song from the White Stripes. Michel Gondry did the video, all in Legos.
All in Legos, yeah.
And that was at a time, Amora, where I think a lot of people, possibly myself included, were thinking the music video was done. Mm-hmm. You know, there was nothing new to see.
Yeah.
And then along comes this thing, and it's like, wow.
Yeah.
I've never seen anything like that before.
Well, and it's funny, too, because I feel like the music video has been pronounced dead a lot, especially lately with, you know, MTV sort of... saving music videos for like the bumpers of their programs,
right.
And then they, you know, they care about them around the Video Music Awards time. But if you look at this exhibit, like especially a lot of the videos that are from, you know, recent years, like there's a whole room dedicated to various projects that the Arcade Fire has done with, you know, expanding the boundaries of what a music video is and how much the user can get involved with it. It's really interesting and it's really kind of heartening to see these people, you know, that are taking these videos that some of them obviously are higher budget than others, but then they're also, you know, just really reinventing the form and making them something to talk about and for users to not just watch but to fully experience.
So it's remix culture taken mm-hmm. taken out of the audio, out of the studio and put
yeah,
into the home.
Yeah, definitely. I mean there's one exhibit where it's just a big tableau of all the tributes to Single Ladies, you know, the Beyoncé video.
Beyoncé song.
And
yeah.
That's really great. And then there's this one sort of goof on, it's not a goof, but it's an experiment with Psy's Gangnam Style video where they strip all the music from it and it's just the ambient sounds that you would hear in the various venues where he is.
Oh.
It's really, really neat. I mean,
so you see hear subway sounds,
yeah,
when he's on the subway.
Right, and the horse and every, you know, the horses and everything. Yeah,
that's
yeah.
funny.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and then there are the literal videos.
The literal videos.
Explain
yes.
what a literal video
so
is.
So a literal video is where the action that is happening on screen is described by the video. And, you know, especially with some of the more conceptual clips from, you know, the early days of music video when things were just really, really crazy and people were just like, well, let's just put somebody with crazy glowing eyes on film, like in Bonnie Tyler's clip for Total Eclipse of the Heart. and that's, you know, I mean, it's kind of turning the old videos into kitsch, but I think it also, you know, allows you to appreciate in what ways the form was being experimented with back then.
So David A. Scott has written lyrics for this literal video mm-hmm. to that Bonnie Tyler song
yes.
called Total Eclipse of the Heart. And so what the singer here is singing are not Bonnie's original lyrics,
right.
but David Scott's actual
descriptions of what's going on in the video, yeah.
Of what you're hearing in that Bonnie Tyler video.
I'm lifting my arms. There's nothing else to shoot, so zoom camera under this arch.
Literal video, taking the shots that you see in the video for the song Total Eclipse of the Heart by Bonnie Tyler, and actually instead of singing those original lyrics, singing, you know, I'm running down a bunch of stairs.
Right, describing the action as it happens. I can't wait for that version to show up in karaoke bars since, you know, that's such a karaoke staple.
The exhibit is called Spectacle, the Music Video. It's at the Museum of the Moving Image in Astoria, Queens through June 16th. Does the exhibit work for you?
I love it. I'm going back. I mean, I was there for about 2 hours last week, and I plan on going back at least, you know, for at least 8 more. I mean, you know, it's so funny too, because the way the video, the way the exhibit is set up, there are certain videos that are on endless loop. And so there's this one song, the Chemical Brothers' Let Forever Be, which is a song, you know, with one of the Gallagher brothers from Oasis on vocals. And it has this video that I never had seen before, because I guess it came out when I was in college and I didn't have cable. And I just watched it, and then set up in this room, because it's all about these kaleidoscopic effects. And there's this room with this like mirror trick where you look like you're in a kaleidoscope as well. And it's just on endless loop. And I think I watched it like 5 times when I was there the other day. But it's really wonderful. And I highly recommend it to anyone who ever plopped down in front of a TV that was showing music videos for hours on end, which I think a lot of people in my cohort did. So,
Maura Johnston is the editor of Maura Magazine. Maura, good to see you again.
Nice to see you too.
That's Let Forever Be by the Chemical Brothers, and featuring Noel Gallagher of Oasis. It's one of the videos featured in the exhibit Spectacle, the Music Video, at the Museum of the Moving Image in Astoria, Queens. We want you to tell us about the first music video that blew you away. Leave a message at 866-939-1612 or tweet us at Soundcheck. That's 866-939-1612 or on Twitter at Soundcheck. The Flaming Lips raised some eyebrows with a video they recently released featuring a spaceman with an eyeball for a head and a downright creepy baby. Now the psych rock band is set to release a new album next week called The Terror, and you can listen to the whole thing right now on soundcheck.org. It's part of our Check Ahead series. Here's a track from it called You Lust. That's the song You Lust from the Flaming Lips. You can stream their brand new album, their forthcoming album, The Terror, for the next week on soundcheck.org. Coming up, the Brooklyn-based group Lucius performs live in our studio, and later the English musician Clint Mansell talks about his film score for the new thriller called Stoker. Soundcheck, I'm John Schaefer. Earlier this year, we introduced you to the Brooklyn quintet Lucius. We did that with a tiny desk concert recorded by NPR. Since then, the band was marked by several outlets as a must-see group at the South by Southwest Music Festival in Austin, Texas. Now, you're going to hear them live in our studio with a song that appears on their self-titled debut EP. This is Lucius and a song called Go Home.
I'm your dolly, stuffed with extra baggage. Lay me down to shut my eyes. Beaded gazes lead ecstatic smile. I think my stitching's coming loose. And I'm hard-headed, but completely soft inside. I'm all wound up and sick.
That is the band Lucius and a live performance here in the Soundcheck studio of a song called Go Home. And I am really glad that we're shooting video for the website for soundcheck.org because the band Lucius, not only do you guys look great, but it's all very symmetrical. Everybody sings, but the lead vocals are by Jess Wolfe. Hi, Jess.
Hi.
And Holly Lessig. Hi, Holly.
Hi.
Each of whom are behind a keyboard, sort of facing each other. And behind each of them is an electric guitarist, Peter Lalish and Andrew Burry. And then off to the side is drummer Danny Malad and everybody dressed in festive green. You're a little late for St. Paddy's Day. Is this, I mean, what's, do you always perform sort of in costume, Jess?
Yeah. I think for us, we wanted to carry over the sort of idea that we were echoing one another, sort of two voices as one. You know, the group is very much like a heartbeat. We need one another to be playing each other's parts. So we wanted visually that to be reflected.
Mm-hmm. And Holly, is everybody in the band on board with this too?
Yeah, yeah, right, guys?
Yes. 100%.
Some sheepish grinning going on in the back row of the band there. So the setup is two electric guitars, two keyboards, and I said drums, but Danny's kit is really just a pair of, like, you know, old field drums that he's turned on end. There's no bass, so how did you come upon this instrumentation? Was it sort of driven by the music, or did you have some visual thing in mind?
I guess I'll answer this one.
That's Danny behind the drum and a half.
It's just one of those things where you try something and it feels like something is evolving, something is happening, and you just kind of take it and run with it. And I think initially the idea of playing standing up came from us rehearsing in a bedroom and trying to keep quiet and then liking how that sounded and then trying it louder. And then the idea that none of us really were a bassist and trying to say, well, we want bass, so how do we implement mm-hmm. that? And it just sort of evolved from there.
So how, Jess, how do you implement that without a bass player?
Well, Pete and I switch off, really. He has this cool pedal that sort of allows him to switch between guitar and bass, or what sounds like bass. And then I have this cool little synth mm-hmm. bass.
Holly, where does the name Lucius come from?
Mm. Well, it comes from Jessica's dog, who is no longer with us but lives on in our band, in his memory. Lucius, the English bulldog.
And how long have you guys been Lucius?
Well, Jess and I came up with the name like 7 years ago or something like that. But the project now is different, even though it's the same name. So mm-hmm. we've been working on this for about a year and a half.
Right, which explains why just now, after 7 years as Lucius, just now you have a debut EP coming out. Mm-hmm. So now you guys are based in Brooklyn, not in, like, you know, Hipsterville, Williamsburg, but in Ditmas Park, which is full of these old, beautiful, like, Victorian homes and stuff. And for a while you guys shared a house there, right?
Yeah.
And the story goes that you moved in and found all kinds of musical surprises.
Yeah, I mean, we found this house on Craigslist, and it didn't mention anything about being a musical house or anything like that, but we were looking for a large house to house eight or nine, you know, musicians. And so we went to go check out this house, and when we went inside, there was a grand Steinway piano from 1921, and there was these old organs, and there was a studio in the basement, and the landlords were totally unfazed. Like,
they had no idea what that meant to somebody like us, you know. And we just, it nurtured our writing habits for the next 2 years and yeah. sort of opened our doors to these guys.
So why did the house have all this stuff in it?
It was a music school and recording studio for about 70 years. And actually, supposedly, even before that, through another family, but the Bromley School of Music. And we later actually got in touch with some of their remaining family members. And you know, I think they both lived and died in the house, and mm-hmm. I think it was probably a lot of expensive equipment and very expensive to move, and they might
just
not have wanted
there.
To deal yeah. with it, yeah.
Is it still there?
Yeah, it's still there.
With the organs and the piano and all?
I mean, I think so.
Wow.
It would not be easy to move some of those pianos from the basement, or, you know, at probably 500 pounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, we are speaking with the band Lucius. You can hear the fruits of their labors on their self-titled debut EP, which is out now. They're also performing on Wednesday, April 10th, at Webster Hall, opening for Caveman. And for our listeners on WDET in Detroit, on April 27th, at the Garden Bowl, which claims to be the oldest continuously operating bowling alley in the country. Have you guys played at a bowling alley before?
Yes, in Brooklyn.
Yeah,
Brooklyn Bowl.
Brooklyn Bowl.
All right, so you know all about it. All right, let's hear another. You want to do Don't Just Sit There?
That'd be great.
All right, it's another song played live in the studio by the band Lucius here in the Soundcheck studio.
Just sit there.
Once again, Brooklyn band Lucius performing in our studio here on Soundcheck. The song's called Don't Just Sit There. Their self-titled debut EP is out now. They're playing tomorrow night at Webster Hall and April 27th in Detroit at the Garden Bowl. We'll hear another song from them later in the show. Still to come, film composer Clint Mansell has helped set the mood for films like The Wrestler, Black Swan, and now, the movie Stoker. He'll talk about his on-screen work and his time leading the band Pop Will Eat Itself. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Clint Mansell's music makes a big impact on the big screen. This music's from Moon, the 2009 film by Duncan Jones, the director, and David Bowie's son. Darren Aronofsky's films have generally sported Mansell scores: The Black Swan, Requiem for a Dream, The Wrestler, The Fountain. But that's not where Clint Mansell thought he was headed when he first broke into the world of music. Clint Mansell was the frontman for the rock band Pop Will Eat Itself back in the 80s and 90s. Now, when he tours, it's with a very different sounding band, one that includes a string quartet. Clint Mansell, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks for having me. Nice to be here.
So you've made a what seems at first to be a pretty big leap from, you know, rock band to film score. Your friend and sometime collaborator Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails has made a similar leap, so apparently it's not without precedent. But how big a transition is that?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose on paper it does seem quite a big transition, but to some degree it's a very age appropriate thing, you know. I mean, I left the band when I was 33, you know, and I had a brilliant time. It's exactly what I wanted to do. I'd seen David Bowie on Top of the Pops when I was like 7 years of age or something, and just thought, I want to be him, you know. I want to be that. I want to do that, you know. And okay, I didn't quite get to his status, but I was in a band playing my own music, toured the world, and had a great time, you know. But at 33, I sort of realized that, you know, I was getting older, really. I was $1 million shy of being a millionaire, and it was becoming harder work. And rock and roll really is a young person's game, I think, you know.
Now, don't you look back at that 33-year-old self and think, what was I thinking? That 33 is young.
33 is young, yeah. I'm 50 now. And you know, I guess I'll make it to 70 and I'll go, wow, 50 was young. But, yeah, I just felt that I didn't really have anything to say in that area, you know. I started getting more interested in instrumental music because lyrically I didn't feel I had anything really to say anymore, you know. And
That's interesting because, you know, you left the pop world, you left Pop Will Eat Itself, mm-hmm. around the time that what we now call post-rock was beginning to coalesce here in the States in places like Chicago and Louisville, which is instrumental music building to a grand climax. It almost sounds like film music itself.
Well, it really does, you know, and I undoubtedly arrived at film composition at a time when I think music was making, or the public's acceptance of music was changing. They were looking for something else. And in bands like Mogwai, Godspeed You Black Emperor, Ziggy Rose, really had a massive influence on me. And I was able to incorporate a bit of that into the film world, which, as I say, fortunately for me, was probably a slightly new, a new take on things, you mm-hmm. know. So I've always said I'm very influenced by those sort of bands. And it's been great. I mean, I worked with Mogwai on The Fountain, you know, and they're just awesome, you know.
Not just Mogwai, the Scottish post-rock band, but you paired them with the Kronos Quartet, uh-huh. the groundbreaking string quartet based mm-hmm. here in the States.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear a little bit of Clint Mansell's score to the Darren Aronofsky film The Fountain. This is called Death is the Road to Awe.
Thank you.
just a bit of Clint Mansell's score to the film The Fountain, Death is the Road to Awe. This combination, Clint, of kind of post-rock, the Scottish band Mogwai, mm-hmm. and the classic sound of the string quartet. I mean, it's Kronos Quartet, but it's still that classic yeah. sound of two yeah. violins, viola, cello. Is that kind of similar to what you did here in New York, your New York performing debut last week?
Yeah, I mean, it has its roots there for sure. You know, I mean, when Darren and I worked with Kronos on Requiem for a Dream, you know, I mean, this was a totally new experience for us. We felt that we really hadn't earned it yet, you know. I'd written the score literally on, you know, synthesizer and string samples, you know, and David Lang orchestrated it from my MIDI stuff.
David Lang, the Pulitzer Prize winning yep. composer based here in New York.
Yeah, he did an absolutely stellar job, you know. And
so now what is your process for writing for film? Do you notate music? Is it all done on computers and keyboards and
yeah,
stuff?
Yeah, it is. Without the computer, I mean, I basically wouldn't be doing this. I mean, I'm not musically trained. You know, you can just build up your ideas, you know, and it becomes then about what I like and what I feel, you know. It's a very personal thing. It's fantastic.
Now, when you're doing a film, and I want to get to some of the newest one, Stoker, in a mm-hmm. moment, but when you're doing a film, you have to write to the director's cues, usually. You know,
yeah.
there are certain visual signposts you need to hit.
Yeah.
On your website, though, are a collection of these very short films, which you've obviously scored. Did the score come first? How do those work?
Those come after the fact. Those are pieces of score from other films. And my friend and collaborator, Agata Alexander, created those videos for us to perform to live.
So Agata Alexander mm-hmm. does the visuals. There are, yeah. I think, three of them on your website at the moment, ClintMansell.com.
Yeah, I've actually got another. I've started a Vimeo page. I've got a channel on there. It's got about six or seven on there now. So,
well, the music we're going to hear, this is from, it doesn't have a title that I could see, but it's the one about the typewriter, the old-fashioned typewriter.
Yeah, that's called Final Movement, and it features Peter Broderick, on vocal, and that's from a film called Last Night that was directed by Massey Tajuddin and starred Keira Knightley. And
so you've repurposed it for this.
We did, because what happened in the film was at the end of the film, in the temp of the score, which is something that film directors do, they use pre-existing pieces of material to get the feeling going, mm-hmm. so you can watch the film with something close to what they're thinking about. She used Peter's song, Peter Broderick's song, Not at Home, and it really was a beautiful ending to the film. The problem was that the rest of the score was very piano-oriented. Peter's song was acoustic guitar, and it sort of felt like another movie all of a sudden. So Peter very, very generously offered to work with me, and we reworked one of my cues from the film to sit alongside his vocal, and he sang the vocal over my score, if you like. And it just came out great, and I said it was very generous of him, and he sort of appears live with us when we perform through the beauty of high-tech modern technology or something like that.
Okay.
But
well,
yeah.
Let's hear a little bit of the music. Clint Mansell with Peter Broderick singing.
Uh-huh.
And Final Movement is the name of it.
Yep. Thank you.
So that's a little bit of Final Movement. You can find the short video and the music on Clint Mansell's website and his Vimeo page. Clint is with me on Soundcheck. Last week made his New York debut as part of the Wordless Music Festival. You can actually hear an audio stream of that show at our online sister station, q2music.org. This piece is obviously a short-form thing, although, as you say, the music came out of a longer experience, a feature film. And it was striking to hear you say that your score was mostly piano-based and Peter Broderick's song was guitar-based, and so it felt like a different movie.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that something as subtle as changing the instrumentation can have that powerful an impact on a film.
Yeah, you know, when you score in a film, really, to some degree, you don't want to draw attention to yourself a little bit. I mean, obviously, I like people to notice the music. I want them to enjoy it. But you don't. When you're scoring a film, you're kind of helping create the universe that the film exists in, you know. So if you do something that takes the viewer out of that unintentionally, that can really be a misstep, you know. I mean, there are times when you do want to take that step, but sometimes once you've created this language, if you like, in this case, it was very piano driven. It does become very noticeable if you take a sideways step, and if that's not the step you really want to take, it can be a problem, you know.
Well, now your latest score is to Stoker,
mm-hmm.
which is out now in the theaters. Another kind of psychological thriller, a genre that you seem to be drawn to.
Yeah,
is that because of Darren Aronofsky, or is this something that you find particularly suitable for your?
Well, I guess I do relate to it. I think, you know, a lot of the films I've worked on generally have a lone protagonist, I suppose. You know, you can look at, Black Swan and Moon are perfect examples of that. Stoker's a similar idea. Requiem for a Dream and Pi both are, Requiem's a little bit more of an ensemble, I suppose, but Pi definitely. And it's about getting in the head of that main actor, you know, and creating a way or helping the audience relate to that character, you know, and a lot of the characters I tend to write for are going nuts, and maybe that's something that's just in me, I don't know.
Well, now here you made a decision at some point that, you know, you wanted this instrumental score, but that at some point you wanted Emily Wells, the violinist, singer, songwriter. She's actually going to be here performing in our studio next month.
Awesome.
Yeah. And so what, now that the score to Stoker has come out, we've got your score, we've got her song, and then there's this bonus track that the two of you do together.
Mm-hmm. I had come across Emily some years ago when she did her first record, I believe, Symphonies, which I really, really liked.
Which is her looping her violin and all this other
and
stuff.
And I'd seen sort of clips of her on YouTube, you know, and I was thinking, wow, that's really cool the way she does that, you know. And then so when I met her and we talked about things, we just thought, well, let's just kick some stuff around, you know, and see where it goes and if there's something we could use, you know. So we did this piece that was basically for the scene where
you're not going to give something away here,
right? No, okay, it's not a spoiler. There's a scene where her uncle Charlie follows India, the young girl, home from school. She's on the school bus and he's driving behind in a car. And we did this piece that sort of was kind of playful and, you know. But it was one of these situations where, because we'd blended different instrument types of things, it sort of stuck out a little bit in the film and sort of took you out a little bit. So in the end, we didn't use it, but we thought, well, you know, we like the piece, so we'll throw it out there as a bonus.
It is a bonus track on the original motion picture soundtrack to the film Stoker by my guest Clint Mansell with Emily Wells.
Thank you.
If I Ever Had a Heart, a collaborative song, Clint Mansell, the composer, and the singer-songwriter-violinist Emily Wells from the score that Clint did to the film Stoker, which is out now, the latest in a series of really well-received film scores from Clint Mansell, whose New York City debut last week with band and string quartet is streaming on our sister station's website, q2music.org. Clint, to sort of come back to where we were at the beginning, do you miss being a rocker? Do you miss the pop will eat itself days?
No, in a word. I mean, I have incredibly fond memories of it, you know, and I'm still friends with all the guys I was in the band with, and that's very important to me. But no, I mean, it was great at the time. I loved it, you know. But what I do now really, it just suits where I'm at personally, you know. Mm-hmm.
And will pop eat itself? Is that what pop has always done?
I guess it has, really, you know. I mean, the original concept of the name was actually from an interview that a journalist called David Quantick did. And in this piece, David pontificated that because pop music steals the best from itself, you know, that's a great bit there, that's a great bit here, and combines it, ultimately, pop will eat itself and you'll end up with one perfect song, you know.
Hmm.
Which really caught our attention back in those days because we really weren't that serious about stuff. You know, we stole pretty much everything. And then the sampler came along, which really embodied that, you know, and it was just a perfect name for us, really. So I got to give David Quantick props for that.
All right. Well, there is a version of the band, Pop Will Eat Itself, that's still out and about.
But go see him.
Clint Mansell, very much tied to the theater, to the sounds of the cinema. We'll wrap up with a bit more from Stoker. Clint, it's been a real pleasure having you with us on Soundcheck.
It's great to be here. Thank you very much.
That's a little more from Clint Mansell's soundtrack to the current film called Stoker. Now, before we leave tonight, we want to give you another chance to hear our musical guest, the Brooklyn band Lucius. Here's the song called Turn It Around from Lucius, live on Soundcheck. Thank you. That's the band Lucius here in our studio with a song called Turn It Around. Find out more info about the band, their debut EP, and watch the music, a video of their performance on soundcheck.org. Tomorrow on the show, as the popular sitcom The Office comes to a close, we talk with actor and musician Creed Bratton, who plays the delightfully creepy character Creed on the show, and in real life is a former member of the 60s band The Grassroots. And singers Terry Walker and Nicole Ray front the new classic soulful sounds of Lady. The duo plays a stripped-down set in our studio. And contributor Faith Saley delves into the puzzling musical mystery of why accents seem to disappear when people sing. A reminder, our check ahead this week is the new album from the Flaming Lips called The Terror. You can stream the whole thing for free all this week on soundcheck.org. That's going to do it for us tonight. See you back here at 9 tomorrow. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.